Good morning to you. I'm Rod Finkel, the President of the Council. I want to thank William Tour, who is sitting over here behind the corner, who is recording our program today. As you know, this program is presented on a podcast available on kska.org, and that will be early next week. Today's program is available for download on the KSKA Public Radio website. Just go to kska.org and hit search and then click on AWAC Presents. I would like to now introduce our head table. To my very far left is Flip Todd, a longtime member of the Board of Directors and a past president. Flip, thank you. Sitting next to him is Michael Cook, who is going to introduce our guest speaker today. And Michael, I'll turn it over to you.
Thank you, Rod. It's my pleasure today to introduce Dr. William Bernstein. Bill Bernstein is a neurologist. He is co-founder of Efficient Frontier Advisors, an investment management firm, and the author of several titles on finance and economic history. Bill is well known as a grassroots hero to independent investors. A practicing neurologist, he comes to the problems of saving and investing as someone who had to figure this out for himself, from first principles up. He's the author of The Intelligent Asset Allocator, the editor of the quarterly asset allocation journal Efficient Frontier, founder of the popular website efficientfrontier.com, and a principal of Efficient Frontier Advisors. The Intelligent Asset Allocator is a plain-spoken guide on how to build a diversified portfolio without the help of a financial advisor. Bill's made a name for himself by questioning the value of Wall Street wisdom, skewering the recommendations of self-serving stockbrokers, and showing legions of investors how to successfully manage their own investments with intelligence and long-term vision. His books on economic history illuminate the keys to success in today's economic environment. We had one of them available here for purchase, but I think it's sold out. A Splendid Exchange, How Trade Shaped the World from Prehistory to Today, explains how our age-old dependency on trade has made us both prosperous and vulnerable, and puts the perennial debate over free trade and protectionism in historical context. I'm sure it can be found on Amazon.com. Mr. Bernstein's ultimate life goal is being able to convey a suitcase full of books and a laptop to Provence for 6 months and still call it work. He's here today to speak to us on globalization. Is today's flat world really anything new? Please join me in welcoming Bill Bernstein to the podium.
Well, first, I'd like to thank all the people who've shown me very kind hospitality here, starting with, of course, Lisa, Carrie, Mike, Bill, all greatly appreciated. I'd like to tell you that this is a subject that I've been interested in for decades, that it was only a matter of time before I wrote a book about the history of world trade, but that's not how these things really happen. What actually happened was that about 5 or 6 years ago, I got a phone call from a man with the unlikely name of Brando Skyhorse. Brando's father was Native American, and his mother was Hispanic. And he called me up and he asked me if I was interested in writing a book about the history of world trade. And I said, well, number one, it's not a subject I'm terribly interested in. Number two, I don't know that much about it. And number three, you've got the wrong Bernstein. The Bernstein you wanted was Peter Bernstein, who's a very well-known economic and mathematical and financial historian. And there followed this sort of awkward silence. And he said, well, we had lunch with Peter last week. And we did offer him the job, and he turned us down flat. He's busy writing his history of the Erie Canal. But he said there was this other Bernstein who just might be interested in the topic. So I said, well, I'll think about it. And I went out from the den where I took the phone call into our family room where my wife was sitting with her last cup of morning coffee and the New York Times crossword puzzle. And I told her the story. And she said, you know, of course, who Grove Atlantic Press is. And I said, no. And she said, well, you've heard of Grove Press. And I said, well, yes, you know, Doris Lessing, Henry Miller, P.J. O'Rourke, and so forth. And she said, right. And you know who the Atlantic Monthly is, what the Atlantic Monthly is. And I said, yeah, I've heard of them too. And she said, that's Atlantic Monthly Press. She said, if you value your career as a nonfiction writer, you will do whatever they ask you to do, even if it's a cookbook. And so next to a cookbook, A History of Global Trade actually sounded pretty good to me. So I attacked the project. And as I began to get myself into the research and do the things that a nonfiction author does to make a topic like this palatable, I discovered that the story is a very, very old one, and that the cracks and the stresses and the dislocations and the discontents of globalization is, in fact, a very old story. And, in fact, if you look at the stories from the 16th through the 19th centuries, you find that they're every bit as wrenching, and the experiences that people went through are every bit as wrenching, and the changes that the world suddenly had to go through in those periods of time are very much more dramatic than things we're dealing with today. What I like to say is that the world suddenly didn't become flat when Al Gore invented the internet. So rather than bore you with reading my book, I'm going to tell you some stories, a couple of vignettes to illustrate the process. And I'm going to pick two stories from the 17th century. I could have picked the 19th or the 15th or the 20th century, but I like the 17th century, so I'll pick two stories from there. And one story starts in the year 1635, when the Spanish barbers, that is the bloodletters of Mexico City, complained to the viceroy about the presence of Chinese bloodletters, immigrant labor, cheap immigrant labor, in the same city, in Mexico City. And they complained, and the viceroy took it very seriously, referred the matter to the city council, who referred back to him the opinion that the number of barbers' establishments should be run by Chinese people should be limited to number of 12. And that they should be banished to the outskirts of the city. Now, exactly what the viceroy decided and exactly what happened, which were almost always two entirely different things, was lost to history. Now, the second story, which I'll then hop over to, begins in the year actually 1931, when a small Australian boy is walking along the beach north of Perth, and he comes across a couple of dozen Spanish coins that were minted in Mexico City in almost the same year, 1635. He brings them to his parents, who bring it to the museum, local museum curator, and they realize that there has to be a shipwreck offshore. They search high and low for it for decades because they realize there's great wealth on board the ship, and they find nothing for 30 years until the year 1963, when some spear fishermen come across the wreck, the hulk, of a Dutch East Indiaman called the Vergulde Drek, the gilt dragon, the golden dragon. And they recover tens of thousands, over 50,000 of these coins. So a couple of questions as I tell these vignettes immediately arise. Number one, what were Chinese barbers doing in Mexico City in 1635? Number two, how did Spanish coins minted in Mexico City find their way to a Dutch East Indiaman from Amsterdam, which then finds its way off of the west coast of Australia, over a century before Sir Captain James Cook supposedly discovered Australia? Now, if we're going to understand those two stories, we have to understand what were the global trade commodities of the 17th century. And it's really simple. They all begin with the letter S, okay? Spices, silk, silver. It is difficult for us in the modern world to understand the grip on the popular imagination that spices held for people in Europe during the Middle Ages. They were, first of all, fabulously expensive, and they came from very far beyond the European geographic horizon. We're talking really about the fine spices, and there's four of them worth talking of. There's nutmeg and mace, which, of course, as most of you know, come from the same plant. There's cloves, which is a separate spice. And then finally, there's cinnamon. The first three of them come from the Spice Islands, so named because they were so far beyond the geographic horizon of European knowledge that we didn't know anything else about them aside from that spices came from them. Cinnamon came from Sri Lanka, modern-day Ceylon. Again, that was well over the geographic horizon of European knowledge at the time as well. And so what you had was an enormous luxury that had to go through dozens of hands before it finally got to Europeans, rising in price at each step along the way, wrapped in mystery and exoticism. And it was a perfect marketing storm. It was the Armani suit and the Godiva chocolate and the Gucci shoe all rolled up into one. And whoever could command this trade would become rich as Croesus, and the nation that commanded it would become the most powerful nation on earth. Columbus and Da Gama and Magellan were not looking for new worlds. They were not looking for souls to save. They were looking for spices, nothing more and nothing less. It was spices that drove the voyages of discovery. Now, the next commodity you have to understand about is silk. Now, silk had been discovered by the Chinese 5,000 years ago and remained a Chinese monopoly for over 3,000 years until around the dawn of the Common Era, when the worms the technology for making them finally got out to Japan. And then about 500 years later, the Byzantine Emperor Justinian commissioned a couple of industrial spies, who in those days were monks, and had them go to China and smuggle out, at risk to their lives, these worms. And on their second trip, after several years of trying, they finally succeeded. And the only thing you really have to know about silk for our purposes here today is the further away you get from China, the lower the quality. So Japanese silk, pretty good. Okay, but if you're a Tokugawa aristocrat in the 17th century, you don't want the local product. You want the real thing from China. Persian silk, India silk, not bad either. Okay, the Europeans tried to get on the act, and they were awful, particularly the Brits. The Brits actually, believe it or not, tried to make silk. And then finally, the worst silk in the world was transplanted by the Spaniards to Mexico, all right, which becomes important in a little bit for our story. Now, the last commodity you have to understand is silver. Now, the question is, what did the Europeans have that in trade for these luxuries that the Asians wanted? And the answer was nothing except silver. The primary manufactured product of Europe at the time was wool, which doesn't really go over all that well in a tropical climate. And the second problem that the Europeans had was they didn't have a lot of silver early on because the great silver mines of Spain and of Central Europe had been played out by late Roman times. And so not infrequently, the poor Portuguese would get to the Spice Islands and having spent what little silver they had outfitting their ships, they had nothing at all to pay for their the spices that they wanted. And they frequently had to seize them, which didn't work very well because they had trouble transporting men in arms those sorts of distances. Now, all of this changes in the years 1547 and 1548, when the great silver deposits of the New World are uncovered by the Spaniards at the Silver Mountain at Potosi in Peru, now in modern Bolivia, and at the ground level deposits in western Mexico in Guanajuato. And all of a sudden, you have this enormous amount of silver flooding the world, producing inflation, but also allowing all of a sudden for a very vigorous trade because now you have something that both sides in the business want. And so the next question that you have to ask is, how did this stuff get around the world in the 16th and the 17th century? And the answer was very, very slowly. The primary motive force, the two primary motive forces in the world of trade before the voyages of discovery and even for some period of time after, were the monsoons, which blow through the Indian Ocean. The Indian Ocean was the primary conduit, in fact, of world trade during that period of time. And the monsoons, as we know, blow twice a year, once from the northeast in the winter, from the southwest in the summer. And the people who ran this trade were all Muslims for two reasons. Number one is they all understood each other's commercial rules. Let us never forget that the Prophet was a trader. All right, Muhammad was a trader, and a significant part of the Quran and an even more significant part of the Hadith, the sayings of the Prophet, have to do with trade. So they understood each other's commercial code. So typically, if you were a Gujarati cloth merchant from northwest India, what you would do is you would take the winter monsoon to east coast of Africa, or better yet, to Jeddah, the main port city of Mecca, and you would take pilgrims, and you would take spices, and you would take cloth. And you would offload those in Jeddah, and you would bring back horses and ivory and maybe some European manufactured goods, such as Italian glass. And you would get back to your home port that same year or within 1 year. You could go in the opposite direction, pick up spices in Batavia or the Spice Islands, and come back, go out with cloth and come back with spices as well. And Chinese merchants could also trade along that north-south axis in very in the same way. So if you were a Muslim, this was very, very good news, because you had a way of getting around and you had a commercial code that and a commercial club almost that you were part of. If you were a European, it was very bad news, okay, for any number of reasons. First of all, before Da Gama rounds the Cape in 1498, a European could not so much as dip an oar into the Indian Ocean. All right. In the second place, it was mathematically impossible to get from Europe to the Spice Islands and back in less than 2 years because of the monsoon system and the monsoon winds and the wind system in the Atlantic Ocean as well. And this was a hot, dangerous, unhealthy trip. About one-third of the vessels never made it back to Europe in any one given journey. More than half of the men who started out from Europe never made it back either. About somewhere between 500,000 and 1,000,000 men in the employ of the Dutch East India Company died during the 17th and 18th centuries in the process. They were mostly Germans, by the way. The Dutch were too wealthy to, you know, want to sign one with the Dutch East India Company. It was the poor people from the sticks out in Germany who signed up for these trips. What was needed if you were a European was a better way of getting around the world. Okay. Well, as we all know, there are trade winds that blow around the world. There's two pairs of them. There's a set just above and below the equator that blows from east to west. Okay, and that's the system that Columbus first used to get very quickly from the Canaries to the Caribbean in a space of about 6 weeks during his journeys. He came back via a more northerly route. And then there's a northern system, and Magellan used that, of course, to travel around the world as well. And the sailors among you know that what pulling a Magellan is. It's traveling around the world, which if you have half a brain about you, you'll do along the equatorial route from east to west. The second system runs at high latitude, about 45 degrees north latitude. And the first Europeans to take advantage of the system were a couple of Spaniards named Alonso de Arellano and Friar Andres de Urdaneta, who in the year 1565 departed from Manila, which was Spanish at the time, and then went north to about the latitude of Japan, and then shot across the North Pacific Ocean to about the level of Oregon or Washington, came down the west coast of North America to Acapulco, and they arrived 4 months later in Acapulco, which was a remarkable navigational feat for the era. Now, let's think about it. Now we've got a system of world trade, okay, because you've got silver in the New World that's in great demand in Asia. So that shoots across on the Manila Galleon, three ships, usually two heavily laden merchantmen and one very heavily armed galleon escorting it. And then that's exchanged for silk and porcelain and whatever else people want in the New World. And it takes the North Pacific route across the ocean. And so all of a sudden you get the wealth of Croesus in the New World being exchanged for the sublime luxuries of the East. And there are people who get very rich off of this trade. The first people to get really rich were the Manilienos, who were Spaniards who initially settled in Manila and then wound up setting up warehouses as well. And there was an Irish friar who lived in Mexico City in the middle of the next century, in the 18th century, who wrote about this, or in the 17th century, who wrote about this. And he wrote, both men and women are excessive in their apparel, using more silks than stuffs and cloths. He was amazed at the thousands of coaches that cruised up and down the Alameda, which was the city's main drag, which were, again, quote, full of gallants, ladies, and citizens to see and be seen, to court and be courted. In the jewelry district, a man's eyes may behold, in less than an hour, many millions worth of gold, silver, pearls, and jewels. Well, now we can begin to understand those first two stories. First of all, how did the Chinese barbers make it from China to the western part of Mexico? Well, the Spaniards, the Manilienos, were very fond of Chinese servants because they cooked very fine cuisine and they were better at servanting than the local Filipinos were. So they would import them to Manila, and they particularly settled at a suburb called Parian, which, if you've ever been to Manila, you've probably been to. It's a primarily Chinese suburb, even to this day, and throughout history has been the site of some pretty ugly, bloody racial riots, which I'm sure we'll see more of in the future. It's part of conflict, racial conflict in Asia, and they would bring their servants across them. To Mexico with them across to Mexico, and their servants would settle down, have children and grandchildren who would enter professions, one of which was barbering, bloodletting. Okay. Now, if we're going to understand how the Spanish coins got to Western Australia, we just need one more piece of the puzzle, and it's a wonderful piece of the puzzle, which is the Roaring Forties. I've told you that there's a high latitude system that blows from west to east in the northern hemisphere, but there's also one at the southern hemisphere at about 45 degrees south latitude, and it really gets going because there's almost no intervening landmass to block it at 45 degrees south latitude. There's a southern cone of South America. There's the South Island of New Zealand, and that's it, okay? And these things get moving 40, 50, 60 knots throughout the year. And the first European to take advantage of this was a Dutch East Indian sea captain by the name of Hendrik Brouwer, who in the year 1611 sets out from Amsterdam for Batavia, now modern Jakarta. And instead of heading northeast after rounding the Cape of Good Hope in Africa, he does something very counterintuitive. He heads basically south into the void toward Antarctica. And he gets whisked along on this conveyor belt and goes for 5,000 miles very quickly in a matter of several weeks, hangs a left, threads the Sunda Strait, and gets to Batavia 6 months after leaving Amsterdam. Again, an amazing feat. This quickly becomes the standard route, of course, for Europeans wanting to get to the Spice Islands, and even for that matter to India, or at least to eastern India. And it had several advantages. Number one, not only was it quicker, not only was it safer, but it was far healthier because it was done at a high latitude, all right, and was cooler. So the provisions stayed fresher longer as well. There was just one problem with this route. You had to know when to turn left. Because if you didn't turn left at the right time and you kept on going, you went splat into the reefs of Western Australia. And Western Australia is nothing but reefs. And over the next 200 years, a couple of dozen ships met that fate. The most spectacular story, one of the first ships to meet that fate, was a ship actually called the Batavia, which in the year 1629 sets out from Amsterdam. And the crew did a couple of really stupid things. The first thing they did was they mutinied. And then the second thing they did right after they mutinied is they killed the navigator. And And so you can well imagine what happens. Now, they lucked out initially. They wound up about two-thirds of the 300 crew and passengers wound up on this waterless reef on which survival would have been tenuous. But survival quickly became more tenuous because most of the people who were on the ship weren't part of the mutiny, and they were now witnesses to a capital crime. And so they had to be disposed of, which the mutineers very slowly did over the ensuing months. And by the time a rescue crew arrived, and I'll put the rescue word rescue in quotes, and I'll explain why in a minute, there were only a handful of people left. They heard this horrible story, which the Dutch East India Company was able to keep under wraps for about three decades before this story finally leaked out and horrified, scandalized all of Europe. Now, the rescue crew wasn't there to rescue the passengers and crew. They were there to rescue the silver chests, 12 of them. They were Gujarati and Dutch divers, experts. And they were able to recover 10 of the 12 chests, all right? Now, the same thing happened to the Vergulde Drek, except there wasn't a mutiny involved. Another rescue crew was sent out, but they found nothing. And in fact, these silver coins went unaccounted for until one day in 1931, a small Dutch boy comes across these coins on the beach. So we see that by the end of the 17th century, all of the elements of what we would today call a globalization were present. There was a global market in the most strategic commodities. There was a highly mobile international workforce. There was an international monetary system in the form of the Spanish 8-real piece, which was the most commonly minted coin. This coin was the $100 bill and Visa card and American Express card of its era. And whether it was in the hands of a lowly Gujarati cloth merchant or in the great trading companies of the time buying coffee and silks and spices, it was the coin of the realm, literally the coin of the realm. It was too big for everyday use, so people would cut it up into eight one-real pieces. This is the origin of our term, of course, 2 bits for a quarter dollar. The Spanish 8-real piece looks surprisingly like our own silver dollar, which is no coincidence, since it was legal tender in the United States until the year 1857. There were also discontents aplenty with global trade in that period. The barbers of Mexico City, the Spanish barbers of Mexico City, as we've already seen, were none too happy with the situation, with all this cheap foreign labor coming in. The Spanish silk growers of both Mexico and Spain were apoplectic. I mean, here were cheap Asian imports that were being dumped in their markets. And they, what did they do? They did what people always do in that situation. They demanded protection. All right, and they got the viceroy and the king of Spain to ban the Pacific trade. Of course, a couple of reals in the right pockets got around that problem. In the year 1697, some English weavers in London rioted in front of Parliament, and then attacked the headquarters of the East India Company, and then attacked the governor of the East India Company, Sir Josiah Child, because the East India Company was importing these wonderful calicos, these cottons, these colored fabrics, the likes of which the poor Brits had never seen. They were gaily colored. They felt good on the skin. They were light. They were not that horribly expensive, and they wanted the trade banned. And they unfortunately, what they did was they did get the trade of finished calicos banned. So then what the companies did, the textile companies did, was they just imported the raw cotton, and they got their own printing and then finally their own weaving industry going in Britain, and it destroyed the entire industry and brought us the Industrial Revolution. As we learned to finally the only thing that was left to import was the raw cotton. The protectionists of England figured, hey, we can, you know, what can they do with raw cotton? Well, that's what the Industrial Revolution, of course, was all about. As Eric Hobsbawm once famously said, he who says Industrial Revolution says cotton. And in the course of writing this book, I came across dozens of stories like this. And all you have to do is modernize the grammar, change a couple of the proper nouns, and you are reading about the latest riot at the latest WTO meeting or the bloviations of some protectionist senator at a trade treaty hearing. It's all happened before. As Harry Truman very famously said, the only thing that's new in the world is the history that you haven't read. And I think that this is a history that we all ignore only at our peril. Now, I'm going to finish up with the global economic crisis. And you're going to ask, what does all this have to do with the global economic crisis? And the answer is everything. Because if you start with the spice trade in the 17th century in England, what you have are these Brits coming back to their native country with incredible wealth, silver, gold, jewels. And we tend to think of England as this majestic imperial nation, but in, you know, the 17th century, England was one of the world's basket cases. It was embroiled in a civil war. It had just chopped off the head of one of its kings. And for our purposes, the way in which it only had about 4 million people in the middle of the 17th century. In population, it was actually less than it was before the Black Death in the middle of the 14th century. But for our purposes, the most important fact that you had to know about England then was that it had no banking system. So what do? You're a rich trader. You come back with all this wealth. There's no bank to put it in. Where do you put it? Well, you put it in a goldsmith shop because those are the places and those are the people who know how to deal with small amounts of great stored wealth. And you would give your 100 pounds of, let's say, silver to the goldsmith, and he would give you a certificate that said, so-and-so has deposited with me 100 pounds of silver. Well, the next step is for the merchant to say, well, that's all very nice, but what I really want is 101-pound notes, okay? That's much more use to me. And so the jeweler says, fine. These things very quickly begin to circulate as money, okay? And they're as good as the banks are. Then the light bulb goes on over the bankers, or I've given it away, goes on over the jeweler's head, and he says, ah, after I give my 100 pounds of notes away to my merchant, why don't I print up another 100 of these notes and I can loan them out at interest and make a fortune, because the risk-free rate in England, even at the highest credits, was about 10% per year. It was a real, it was a money machine, basically. And the only problem would be that if you printed up too many notes and they all came back to you, and if there was some scandal or somebody started a rumor, then you would have a run on the jeweler shop. Well, these things very quickly evolved into banks. This is the birth, as we all know, of fractional reserve banking. All right, and the very earliest bankers very quickly figured out that a reserve ratio of about 2-1 seemed to be the most stable. But with the chartering of the Bank of England, which functioned as basically the world's first real central bank, the banking system over the centuries was able to develop to the point where we now got to the modern ratio of about 10-1. What starts happening in 1600 with this? Well, what starts happening are financial crises. Okay, how do we get these financial crises? Well, you've got a source of credit, okay, which can almost infinitely expand because you can take these loans, this money that's being printed by the bankers, and don't ever forget, bankers print money, okay? You know, when you go to get out a loan, you're not taking coins and money from them. You're getting cut a check. It's a check that they wrote. That's money that they just printed, all right, backed supposedly by the reserves in their bank. I mean, the old banker's joke comes that if I have a dollar in my vault, how much of it can I lend out? And the bank, you know, the student in the banking class says, well, 90 cents, 50 cents, 10 cents? The answer is $9. Under our system. So this system, you can apply loans from one bank to a deposit, the vault at another bank, and you can almost get this daisy chain of rapidly increasing financial capital. Unfortunately, that runs very rapidly going forward, but it runs very rapidly, just as rapidly, if not more rapidly, in reverse. Okay, the first person who lends the money comes and says to Bank A, I want my money back, and then Bank A calls the reserves back from Bank B and Bank C, and the whole thing runs in reverse, which is what happened in 2008. to us. And we get these cycles of euphoria and depression, which alternate between expansion and contraction. And during the contractions, we get financial crises. And if you look at financial history, starting in about the year 1600 or so, you can count about 46 of these things. Well, divide 400 years by 46, and you've got once every 9 years. Well, guess what's happened to us about once every 9 years? And so basically what we've learned is that the invisible hand of Adam Smith does occasionally become palsied. And you do need firm and wise government regulation. Now, if there was one silver lining to this crisis, from my perspective, and what I watched this unfold as I was writing this book, I thought to myself, my God, we're going to see another round of protectionist trade wars, just like we saw in the 1930s with Smoot-Hawley. You get the Depression, people demand protection during depressions, and you get a spiral of escalating tariffs. And you get a trade war, which, by the way, probably escalated into a shooting war in Europe, because most people in our State Department at least believed that the primary driving force behind World War II had a lot to do, at least, with Adolf Hitler gaining power because of the troubles in Germany relating to not only the humiliation of Versailles, but also the fact that the Germans couldn't fix the reparations problem without exporting, which they couldn't do because of our tariffs. No Smoot-Hawley tariff, no Hitler. No Hitler, no World War II. All right? Because remember, Hitler got basically elected into office over a very thin margin in 1933. And what puzzles me as someone who's a student of financial and economic history is we obviously learned from Smoot-Hawley this time around. No one with a brain, I think, this time around in a policy position wanted to start a trade war, and we very carefully stayed out of it. It's going to be a long time in the same vein before the European Central Bank starts printing money the way the Germans and the Hungarians did in World War I and World War II. But so we've learned those lessons, but we haven't learned the lessons of financial history when it comes to regulating credit expansion. We keep stepping on the same rake once every decade. And I, as a neurologist, I have some ways of explaining that, having to do with how human beings get addicted to making money very quickly by pushing buttons. My deepest fear is it looks like we are going to get some meaningful financial regulation in the coming months enacted. But I'm very afraid that 30 years from now, some new Ronald Reagan is going to come along and some new Margaret Thatcher is going to come along and convince people of the genius of the unfettered markets. And we're going to get these laws repealed again, which is exactly, of course, what happened in the 80s. So with that, I will leave it open to questions.
Thank you. I can't remember the name of the author, but he suggested that the Chinese actually discovered America and that this is well known in the non-Western world because the New World has chickens and all trade techniques that originated in China before Columbus. Do you find his theory valid?
No, you're talking about Gavin Menzies. His book, I believe, is How the Chinese Discovered America, and his theory is that the eunuch admiral Zheng He in the 15th century discovered America. I didn't talk a lot about it. Most of the nautical historians I surveyed didn't think much of his theory. But there certainly are some things that do suggest that Asian peoples did travel to the United States. You can see certain patterns of textiles in South America and in Western Asia that mathematically could not have occurred by chance. They're nearly identical. So I do believe that Asians probably did visit the North America before Columbus did, but I just don't think it happened the way that Menzies said it happened.
Question down here.
First, I want to thank the World Affairs Council for making the book
available the week before the presentation. I think that's an excellent idea, and I've enjoyed reading the book, and it resulted in my coming to the luncheon two times in a row, which is unusual for me. Secondly, I would like to just tell you how much I'm enjoying reading the book. It's a very good read, and I'm thoroughly enjoying it. But it has prompted a question because there was a statement made early on in the book relating to the importance of the camel as a trade form of cargo movement of the spices and so forth that you're talking about. And the fact in there, or the statement in there, that intrigued me was the notion that the camel actually had its origins in North America and migrated to their southern locations over the Beringa, essentially through Alaska. And the only remnant I see of anything that looks like a camel now would be a moose. Would you care to comment on the justification for that assertion?
Well, it's a fascinating subject. I don't think it's one of much dispute among evolutionary biologists. There were all sorts of megafauna here before human beings arrived in North America. Saber-toothed tigers, vast sloths, woolly mammoths, and they all disappeared when man came because, as one historian said, these were animals that had no natural predators, and when the first human beings arrived in North America, the hunting was good. And the predecessors of not only camels, but horses originated in North America. And it's the most amazing. The story of the horse is actually even more amazing because, of course, horses had their evolutionary source in North America. They disappear from North America with the first human beings that came here 20 or 30,000 years ago. Then they're bred in Asia and in Europe, and they wind up back in the United States, finally in the hands of the most spectacularly the Cherokees and the Comanches, who used them to great military effect and were able to expand their territory. But they got them from the Spanish. They weren't native horses. Now the same thing happened with the camel, and the camel's a rather unfortunate animal. Because at least the horse is fast. It can get away from predators. But these poor camels, they're really pretty slow. And they didn't last very long with the saber-toothed, the big cats that came along that evolved later in North America. So they wind up as their last refuge in the Eurasian continent. And they don't do very well there either for much the same reason. And they're about hunted to extinction by their predators. The only place they can survive is in the deserts, okay, where they can stay far away from the oases where the lions and tigers and the big cats are. And they're about to go extinct when about 4,000 years ago human beings discover how really good they are for carrying cargo. They can carry, a good hybrid camel across an F1 cross between a Bactrian and a dromedary, a 1 and a 2-humped camel, can carry up to a half ton of cargo 3 or 4 miles an hour all day long. And it wasn't the spice trade, it was the incense trade. Which predated the spice trade by a couple of thousands of years, and the camel was the ideal animal for that because, of course, incense is produced in southern Arabia, and in order to get it to the ancient Mediterranean world, you needed an animal that could travel through the desert. The Red Sea is not the world's best place to try and navigate even today, so the camel wound up as the primary beast of burden. They brought several thousand of them to Australia. The railroad comes and obviates the need for them, but now there are probably 500,000 camels, feral camels in Australia right now, cluttering up the landscape.
Early on, you made a reference to the possibility of, or prediction of, race riots in China, as I understood. Do you have some general theory of how race riots occur and why not Arizona, say, for example?
Can't possibly happen there. Actually, it wasn't China I was talking about. I was talking about the Philippines. And this is, are there any people of Asian extraction here? Yeah, I mean, you know, the experience of the Chinese is very similar to the experience of the Jews, which is that, you know, there are an expatriate population that's foreign to the places they've moved to that's very good with business, and they wind up loaning money to local farmers, and that doesn't make you popular. Among other things, and so you know, it's envy of talent and industry, nothing more, nothing less. And there have been riots, Chinese Filipino riots, for probably 1,000 years. There were Chinese there before even the Spaniards came, and they've been killing each other for a long time, and they will probably continue to do so, unfortunately, in the future, I'm afraid.
I read some history recently of Mongolia. Did your research reveal just how much the Mongolians transported goods around the world and why it ended?
Yeah, a fascinating story. The people tend to think that silk came from the Silk Road. And for most of history, it didn't because it was much cheaper and much safer to transport it circuitously by sea through the South China Sea and through the Indian Ocean and up the Red Sea into the Mediterranean. That was actually cheaper and safer than trying to do it across the Silk Road because land routes are not only inherently more difficult to maintain, but they're also politically unstable as well. The one exception to that, or there were several exceptions, but the one longest exception was the period of Mongol domination during the 13th and 14th centuries, when there was this sort of Pax Mongolica throughout most of Asia. And then goods did move very rapidly over these camel routes over the so-called Silk Road, which wasn't one road. It was this web, this tangle of routes. The most important thing that came over the Silk Road was the plague. Which originated in northern China and then arrived in Kaffa, at the port of Kaffa, which was the genuine eastern terminus of their trade route and the western terminus of the Mongol trade route. And that basically destroyed not only a third of the population of Europe, killed a third of the population of Europe, but as much as a half to three quarters, and in some places 90% of the key trading outposts in Asia, because those were the places that were hardest hit. These things were transported in the fur of camels and, of course, on ships, rats on ships. And so it becomes a very key part of the trade story. That's chapter 9 of my book, I think.
One more question?
I wonder if you have had a chance to analyze the Clovis comet theory. There's indications by physicists that there was an explosion or an impact in the Great Lakes region 13,000 years ago that caused the extinction not only of the Clovis culture of Indians, but all the large extinct mammals such as the cave bear, the horse, the camel, the saber-toothed tiger, the ground sloth, the 135 species of large animals that Indians were blamed for making extinct. It now appears that a cometary impact in that region, either hitting the glacier or hitting in the Great Lakes, caused the Great Extinction.
Yeah, I mean, that's not a part of the trade story. But I've come across it, and I think it's reasonably credible. One of the things that we as Americans really don't understand is that Yellowstone is this vast volcanic cauldron that periodically blows, and when it does, which happens every million, half million years, it's cataclysmic. I mean, we're talking about civilization ending.
Thank you very much.
As a token of our appreciation, we'd like you to take this book on Alaska provided by Todd Communications. Thank you very much, Doctor. Fascinating.
Thank you much, sir.
Next Friday, we will have the President of the World Affairs Councils of America, Mr. Kirk Talbot, who will speak to us, and we hope to see you all then. Thank you for coming.